A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those questions where the more you sit with it, the more it rearranges how you think about something you've been doing wrong for years. The job interview is supposed to be a two-way evaluation, but structurally it's built as a one-way interrogation with a courtesy question tacked onto the end. Do you have any questions for us? Shows up in the final 5 minutes, and most candidates treat it like a politeness ritual. Ask something safe, smile, get out. Daniel wants to know how to flip that. Not by asking blunt, off-putting questions about retention rates or Glassdoor scores, but by weaving genuine intelligence, gathering into the conversation, so naturally the interviewer doesn't realize they're being probed. How do you surface the non-obvious stuff? Culture, red flags, whether you'll actually like working there, without sounding like you're conducting an audit.
The most dangerous question in an interview isn't, what's your biggest weakness? It's, do you have any questions for us? Because how you answer that question determines whether you accept a job at a toxic company or dodge a bullet. And most people are walking into that moment completely unarmed.
The timing makes it worse. You've just spent 45 minutes being evaluated. Your brain is fried. You're performing. Then they hand you the mic and say, any questions? And the social pressure is to wrap things up gracefully, not to start a second interrogation.
The structural problem here is that interviews are asymmetrical power dynamics disguised as conversations. The company gets the full session to evaluate you. You get a 5-minute courtesy window at the end. That's not a two-way street. That's a one-way evaluation with a turn signal that blinks twice and shuts off. And the research backs up how broken this is. Average employment tenure in the U.S. has dropped below 4 years as of the most recent data. The cost of a bad cultural fit has never been higher, and yet candidates are still treating the Q&A portion like it's a formality.
Before we get into the actual techniques, because I know you've been digging into this, let's name the thing we're actually trying to solve. This isn't just a preparation problem, where if you wrote down better questions the night before, you'd be fine. It's a tradecraft problem.
Explain that distinction.
A preparation problem assumes the interview is a straightforward information exchange. You ask a question. They give an honest answer. You evaluate it. But that's not what's happening. Companies have scripted answers for the obvious questions. What's the culture like? Triggers a rehearsed paragraph about collaboration and innovation. You learn nothing. Tradecraft is about elicitation, getting the other party to reveal information without realizing they're being probed. The goal isn't to trick anyone. It's to bypass the script and access what's actually true.
This is exactly the framing that makes the most sense here. And it's not just a metaphor. The intelligence community has entire doctrines around elicitation techniques. The core insight is that people are bad at lying about specifics they haven't rehearsed. So if you ask an abstract question like, what's the culture like, they can give you the company values poster from memory. But if you ask a concrete question that forces them to describe a specific situation, you get the unvarnished version, because they haven't prepared a fake answer for that.
The cost of getting this wrong is higher than people think. Glassdoor reviews are retrospective. They're skewed by extremes. People who are furious or people who are thrilled. And they're often moderated by legal teams. The real red flags live in the gap between what a company says about itself and what its employees actually experience day to day. You can't get that from a website.
We've established the problem. The interview is structurally rigged against genuine two-way evaluation. But knowing the problem isn't enough. Let's talk about the actual techniques that fix it.
Walk me through what you've found. What actually works?
There are 3 techniques I want to go deep on, and they all share the same psychological mechanism. They reframe the question from abstract evaluation to concrete storytelling. Technique 1 is what I'm calling the future state projection. Instead of asking, what's the culture like, which, as we said, gets the canned answer, you ask, what does success look like in this role 6 months from now? Or, a year from now, how will you know you made the right hire?
Why does that work differently?
because it forces the interviewer to describe actual working conditions. They have to think about deliverables, team dynamics, what resources you'll have, what problems you'll be solving. Harvard Business Review published research on this back in 2022. Candidates who asked, "What does success look like in this role?" received 15% more detailed responses than those who asked, "What's the culture like?" 15% more detail is significant. That's not just more words, it's more concrete information you can actually evaluate.
You can hear the difference in real time. If someone says success looks like shipping the product roadmap on schedule, that tells you something about how this company thinks about roles. It's output-focused, deadline-driven. If they say success looks like the team feeling more confident about our architecture decisions, that's a different signal entirely. You're learning about what the organization actually values.
And here's the thing. You're not just gathering information. You're also signaling something about yourself, but we'll get to that later. Technique 2 is the predecessor probe. This one is deceptively simple. You ask, what did the person who previously held this role move on to do?
Oh, that's good. Because the answer is either going to be very comfortable or very uncomfortable.
If they left for a promotion internally, that's a green flag. It means the company develops people and this role is a stepping stone, not a dead end. If they left the company entirely, you follow up, gently, with what was the primary reason they gave for leaving. Now, here's the tradecraft part. You're not just listening to the answer. You're watching how comfortable the interviewer is giving it. If they get defensive, if they deflect, if they suddenly give you a very careful, legally vetted sounding answer, that tells you turnover is a sensitive topic in this organization. And sensitive topics are where the red flags live.
There's a real example of this, isn't there? Someone who used this exact question and uncovered something Glassdoor had completely missed.
Yeah, I came across a case. A candidate at a fintech startup asked the predecessor probe and discovered the last three people in the role had left within 6 months. Unrealistic sales targets. The Glassdoor reviews for this company were positive overall, because most of the reviews came from engineering and product teams. The sales team's experience was buried. One question surfaced what a dozen Glassdoor pages couldn't.
That's the gap we were talking about. Aggregate ratings don't capture department-level dysfunction. And the third technique?
Technique 3 is the constraint cascade. And I'll be honest, this is the high-risk, high-reward one. You ask, what's the single biggest frustration your team has faced in the last quarter?
That's a bold question.
But here's why it works. A good, healthy organization will give you a real answer. Something like, we had budget constraints that delayed a key hire, but we've reallocated and we're solving it. That signals transparency and problem-solving culture. A dysfunctional organization will deflect or blame another department or give you something vague like just the usual growing pains. The quality of the answer tells you whether this team has psychological safety, whether people are allowed to acknowledge problems without fear.
If they can't answer it at all? If there's a long pause and then something non-committal?
Then you've just learned something extremely valuable in about 10 seconds of awkward silence. The inability to name a frustration doesn't mean there are no frustrations. It means they're not discussed openly.
All three of these techniques share the same underlying mechanism. You're not asking rate the culture on a scale of 1 to 10. You're asking, tell me a story about a specific situation. And, as you said, humans are bad at lying about specifics they haven't rehearsed. The company values poster didn't prepare them to fake an answer about why the last person quit.
And I want to be clear about something. None of these questions sound like you're conducting an audit. They sound like a thoughtful candidate who's genuinely interested in the role. What does success look like is a question that signals you want to deliver. What happened to the previous person signals you're thinking about career growth. What's been frustrating lately signals you want to understand the real challenges before you step into them. The framing is natural because the intent is natural.
There's a subtlety here worth pulling out. When Daniel talked about questions that get read the wrong way, like asking directly about retention rates, the problem isn't that the question is invalid. It's that it signals distrust before trust has been established. It's like asking someone on a first date about their divorce settlement. The information might be relevant, but the framing makes you sound like you're expecting the worst.
The tradecraft approach solves this by embedding the probe inside a question that sounds forward-looking and constructive. You're not asking, why do people leave? which sounds like you're already planning your exit. You're asking, where did the last person go? Which sounds like you're curious about career paths. Same information, completely different signal.
Those three techniques are powerful, but they're just tools. The real skill is knowing when to use which one, and with whom. That's where the tradecraft gets interesting.
This is the part I find fascinating. Because not all interviewers are created equal, and asking the right question to the wrong person gets you useless answers. A hiring manager and an HR recruiter have completely different incentives and completely different information. The hiring manager knows what's actually happening on the team. The interpersonal dynamics, the technical debt, the project that's been on fire for 6 months. The recruiter knows company-wide patterns, growth trajectories, compensation bands, whether people tend to stay for 2 years or 10. If you ask the recruiter about team-specific frustrations, they might not know. If you ask the hiring manager about the company's 5-year retention trends, they might not have that data.
You tailor the probe to the person.
Ask the hiring manager about team dynamics and project specifics. The constraint cascade. What's the biggest frustration your team has faced? That's a hiring manager question. Ask the recruiter about growth trajectories and company-wide patterns. The predecessor probe can work with either, but you'll get different layers of information from each.
There's a knock-on effect here that I think is even more important than the information you gather. The questions you ask signal your own value. Interviewers are subconsciously judging candidates by the sophistication of their questions. Forbes published a piece on this back in 2021. Ashley Stahl wrote about how thoughtful questions signal confidence and raise your perceived value as a candidate. Asking, "What's your average retention period?" marks you as someone who's been scrolling Glassdoor with a skeptical eye. But asking, "How does this team handle failure?" marks you as someone who thinks about process and growth.
That's a perfect segue to something I want to add to the toolkit, the failure question. When something goes wrong on the team, what happens next? Or, can you tell me about a recent project that didn't go as planned and how the team responded? This is one of the most revealing questions you can ask, because it directly probes for psychological safety. A team with healthy culture will describe a post-mortem process, or a blameless retro, or a manager who helped them extract lessons. A team with unhealthy culture will get uncomfortable. They'll say, "We don't really have failures," which is a lie. Or they'll describe a process where someone was held responsible, which tells you everything you need to know.
There was a case study in that Forbes piece, wasn't there? Someone who used the failure question and discovered the team had no post-mortem culture at all.
The candidate asked about how the team handled failure, and the answer revealed that projects just moved on without any structured learning process. No one stopped to ask what went wrong or how to prevent it next time. That's a cultural red flag that would have been completely invisible in a standard interview, and it speaks to a lack of psychological safety. People don't discuss failures because it's not safe to discuss failures.
Let's build out the framework here. We've got techniques that probe for different categories of information. I think it's useful to organize them into what I'd call a red flag taxonomy. 3 buckets you're trying to fill. Bucket 1 is structural red flags, high turnover, unclear reporting lines, roles that keep getting redefined. The predecessor probe maps to this bucket. Bucket 2 is cultural red flags, defensiveness, blame culture, lack of psychological safety. The failure question and the constraint cascade map here. Bucket 3 is role-specific red flags, unrealistic expectations, scope creep, the job description that describes 3 different jobs, the future state projection. What does success look like? Maps to this one.
That taxonomy is useful because it gives you a checklist without feeling like a checklist. Before an interview, you prepare 1 tradecraft question for each bucket. That's manageable. And you practice them until they feel conversational, not scripted. The goal is to make the interviewer forget you're asking a prepared question at all.
There is another dimension here that I think is worth exploring. When you deploy these questions, matters almost as much as which questions you ask. The standard format, cramming all your questions into the final 5 minutes, is the worst possible approach. Because by minute 45, the interviewer is tired. They're thinking about their next meeting. And you've just spent the entire session being evaluated without establishing any parity. Then you suddenly switch to evaluation mode, and it feels jarring. It feels like the courtesy turn signal you described earlier.
What's the alternative?
Flip the script from the beginning. In the first 5 minutes of the interview, After the handshake and the small talk, you say something like, "Before we dive into my background, I'd love to understand what problem you're hoping this role solves." That single move does several things at once. It establishes that you're there to evaluate them too, but in a way that sounds engaged and curious rather than entitled. It gives you information early that you can use to tailor the rest of your answers. And it makes your later questions feel like natural follow-ups, rather than a checklist you pulled out at the end.
That's what I'd call the reverse interview frame. You're not waiting for permission to ask questions. You're weaving inquiry throughout the conversation, and it changes the power dynamic without being confrontational about it. You're not saying, "I have demands." You're saying, "I want to understand the context so I can give you better answers." Same outcome, completely different framing.
Interviewers actually like this. It signals confidence and preparation. It signals that you're someone who thinks strategically, not someone who just answers questions and hopes for the best. That Forbes research we mentioned. The finding was specifically that thoughtful questions raise your perceived value. You become more desirable as a candidate when you demonstrate that you're also evaluating them.
There's a flip side to this that's worth stating explicitly. If an interviewer penalizes you for asking thoughtful questions, if they get defensive or dismissive or try to rush past your questions to get back to interrogating you, that is the most valuable information you will get in the entire process. A company that doesn't want you to evaluate them is a company that has something to hide. And walking away from that is a win, not a loss.
The ultimate reframe is that you're not just selling yourself. You're conducting due diligence on a multi-year investment of your time and energy. If you're going to spend 40-plus hours a week somewhere, the asymmetry of the standard interview format is actually absurd when you step back and look at it. They get references, background checks, multiple rounds of interviews, skills assessments. You get a Glassdoor page and 5 minutes of Q&A.
Glassdoor, as we said, is incomplete at best. It's retrospective, it's skewed toward extremes, and it's often moderated. I've seen reviews that clearly had paragraphs removed by legal. The real texture of working somewhere, the daily experience, the way managers handle conflict, whether people feel safe admitting mistakes, that doesn't show up in star ratings.
You've gathered all this information across multiple interviews. How do you actually decode what you've heard and make a decision?
This is where most candidates drop the ball, even the ones who ask good questions. They rely on memory and gut feeling. But memory is unreliable, especially after a stressful interview. So here's a protocol I'd recommend. Within 30 minutes of the interview ending, before you do anything else, write down not just what they said, but how they said it. Tone, hesitation, deflection. Did they pause for an unusually long time before answering the predecessor question? Did their voice change when you asked about team frustrations? The emotional texture of their answers is often more revealing than the content.
That's the clinical diagnostician in you coming out. You're looking for symptoms, not just self-reported conditions.
And then you compare notes across interviewers. If the hiring manager told you the last person left for a great opportunity, but the recruiter said something vague about pursuing other interests, that inconsistency is a signal. If one interviewer was comfortable discussing failures and another got visibly uncomfortable, that tells you something about which parts of the organization are healthy and which aren't.
There's a rule I want to propose here. Call it the two-question minimum. Never accept the "do you have any questions?" Prompt with just one question. Have at least two genuine follow-ups ready. The first question breaks the ice and gets you the surface-level answer. The second question, which builds on what they just said, is where the real information lives. Because the second question can't be prepared for, it forces the interviewer to think rather than recite.
You mentioned the last person left for an internal promotion. What skills did they develop here that made that possible? That's the second question. It builds on their answer, it shows you're listening, and it digs deeper into whether this role actually develops people or just consumes them.
Let's pull all of this together into something you can actually use in your next interview, starting tomorrow.
The actionable framework is this. Before your next interview, prepare 3 tradecraft questions, one for each bucket in the taxonomy: structural, cultural, role-specific. For structural, the predecessor probe. What did the person who previously held this role move on to do? For cultural, the failure question or the constraint cascade. What's the biggest frustration your team has faced recently? Or, when something goes wrong, what happens next? For role-specific, the future state projection. A year from now, how will you know you made the right hire?
Practice them until they feel like something you'd actually say, not something you memorized from a podcast.
The goal is conversational fluency. If it sounds scripted, it loses power. The interviewer needs to feel like they're having a genuine conversation with a thoughtful candidate, not being subjected to an information extraction protocol, even though that's exactly what's happening.
Then deploy them in the right order with the right people. Open with the reverse interview frame in the first 5 minutes. What problem are you hoping this role solves? That sets the tone. Weave the other questions throughout the conversation as natural follow-ups. Save one for the formal Q&A at the end so you're not empty-handed, but don't save all of them. The two-question minimum applies whenever you get an answer. Follow up once before moving on.
Then the post-interview decode. Within 30 minutes, write down the answers and the emotional texture. Compare across interviewers. Look for inconsistencies, deflections, and discomfort. Those are your signals.
The thing I keep coming back to is this. The best interview question isn't the one that gets you the job. It's the one that saves you from accepting the wrong one. The power isn't in the answer. It's in the asking. Because the act of asking thoughtful questions doesn't just gather information. It changes how you're perceived. It changes the power dynamic. And it changes how you feel walking out of the room. You're not a supplicant hoping to be chosen. You're an adult making a consequential decision about where to invest your time.
The company that penalizes you for that is the company you don't want to work for. That's not a platitude, it's a filtering mechanism. If asking, what does success look like in this role, gets you a defensive or dismissive response, you have your answer. Decline the offer. The system worked.
One open question before we wrap, and this is where things get interesting for the future. What happens when AI interviewers start asking the questions? Companies are already deploying AI screening tools. Some are experimenting with fully automated first-round interviews. How do you practice tradecraft against a system that doesn't have emotional tells, doesn't get defensive, doesn't have conversational tangents you can probe?
That's unsettling to think about, because all of the techniques we just described depend on human interaction. The pause, the tone shift, the deflective answer. None of that exists with an AI. You'd need an entirely different playbook.
It's the inverse problem. With humans, the challenge is bypassing the script to get to the truth. With AI, the challenge might be that there is no truth behind the script. Just a language model generating plausible-sounding answers that have no necessary connection to what the company is actually like.
Something to dig into in a future episode. But for now, for the interviews that still involve actual humans, the framework stands. Prepare 3 tradecraft questions. Practice them until they're conversational. Deploy them early and throughout. Decode within 30 minutes. And remember that the question that feels bold to ask is often the one that saves you 6 months of misery.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, a group of Ethiopian Orthodox monks living in the Comoros developed a theory that the game of Jenna, Ethiopian Christmas hockey, had been divinely revealed to King David as a form of tactical military training, and that the Ark of the Covenant itself contained a ceremonial Jenna stick. The theory was considered mainstream in certain monastic circles for nearly 40 years before being abandoned.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's about to walk into an interview, or better yet, tell them before they accept an offer they'll regret. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.